I have successfully pulled off the great GitHub space heist.
Did they catch you?
No, they didn't. It's brilliant.
Well, you better not talk about it on a podcast then.
It's all right. Nobody's listening.
It's doubly awkward because I've made my space heist a GitHub action. So one way or another, they know I've done it.
Okay. What are you talking about?
Okay. So I build lots of things with GitHub actions, and that's all just fine and dandy. But occasionally I need to build big things. And what I'm about to explain is kind of focused on building things with Nix, but actually the little life hack that I've found, you can apply to other things as well. And I'll get into a little bit of that in a moment. But the concept here is I needed lots of space to build large Nix configurations, particularly my OS configurations for my workstations, which have lots of big stuff in them, like browsers, DaVinci Resolve, you know, audio players, a whole bunch of Electron applications, full development environments, lots of language ecosystems, all of that sort of stuff. And consequently, that exhausts what at first glance appears to be 20 gigabytes of available space on a standard GitHub runner.
That's running Ubuntu.
Yes, so it's running Ubuntu latest or whatever version you want to use, and there's a GitHub action from Determinate Systems that installs Nix for you, and then you can do Nix things in an Ubuntu machine. And like Nix builds for like small packages are just fine, but for these OS things, not so good, because it runs out of space. And the reason why I want to build my whole configuration is because if I build it, then I can cache the results in my own private flake cache. And then that means that my system updates are fast and I don't have to do any local compiling or anything like that. So that was my motivation. I wanted to figure out how to make more space. And looking around in the GitHub Actions marketplace, there are actions which delete lots of things from the Ubuntu runners in order to claim back some space. And I thought, well, that's an interesting idea. We could do some of that. The problem with that is it takes a long time. We'll get back to that in a little bit. But what I did is I made a little debug thing to sort of go, an action to go poking around in the Ubuntu runner to sort of tell me about it. And I discovered there is a /MNT partition in a GitHub runner. Historically, those used to be 14 gigabytes, which is interesting. And this is 14 gigabytes of space that you wouldn't ordinarily have access to. But today, they are now 65 gigabytes in size in the standard GitHub runner.
That's free space. Can I upload all of my photos into there or something?
Yeah. So the idea I had was, what if I created a GitHub action that creates a partition inside that space as the /Nix volume, where Nix does almost all of its things. So the long story short is that's exactly what I did, and I called this GitHub action Nothing But Nix. And this is for those people who are running a Nix workflow and all they care about is having enough space for Nix. And the first thing it does is it creates a sparse file using Fallocate for the size of the mount partition, less a little bit of reserve, which you can configure. And then it formats that sparse file with ButterFS in a RAID 0 configuration, and then mounts that volume as /Nix. And hey, voila, you now have 65 gigabytes of space for your /Nix volume.
Two questions. Number one, I find it interesting that you pronounce it Fallocate. Moving on. Is there any particular reason you use ButterFS?
Yes, I'll get to that in just a moment. It's because you can do clever things with ButterFS that you can't do with the other file systems unless you get into using LVM and stuff like that. And I wanted to keep it as simple as possible. So having created my 65 gigabytes of space, I then thought, well, there's this other sort of approximate 20 gigabytes of space in the root partition. What if I could claim some of that back as well? So then what it does is it goes and creates another sparse file in the root partition. It then enrolls that sparse file into the ButterFS volume I've already created and then grows and balances that file system. So now you have 85 gigabytes of space available. So this is all going swimmingly at this point. And what was interesting about this is that you do run into issues. If you exhaust all of the space in the root file system, then, you know, bad things start happening. And there are some things that are happening in the root file system that you need to preserve some space for. So I then had the bright idea of, well, let's do the other strategy that everyone else does, which is go and delete a bunch of stuff. So instead of just doing big deletes of files, I thought we could do this properly. So the action creates the 65 gigabyte volume, which it can do in about 1 second. So, you know, instantly 65 gigabytes. You can then move on with the rest of your workflow. So in the background, nothing but Nix then creates a new process that runs in the background that goes off and elegantly apt removes and purges a whole bunch of the stuff that the GitHub runners automatically provide in order to give, you know, every language imaginable, every build tool imaginable.
You talk about doing it properly with apt, you know, auto remove or whatever. Does some of the other actions just like RM, RF, like slash user bin and stuff like that?
They do. And in fact, I have to do a little bit of that as well. And we'll get into that. So whilst the rest of the action is running, nothing but Nix has kicked off this large apt get remove purge in the background, and it removes gigabytes of stuff. Then the next thing it does is in slash user local on the runners is a whole bucket load of just random stuff that's been jammed in there that hasn't been apt installed in a correct way. And I thought, well, I don't need any of that, so I can just RM RF that and just brutally extract it. And this is where you run into an interesting problem. Turns out that takes a long time. RM minus RF on a large slash user local, I think it's like 10 or 15 gigabytes of stuff that's in there. It took between 11 and 16 minutes to RM minus RF that from the VM that is the Ubuntu host runner, which is a bit too long. Like you couldn't, and this is the problem with some of these other actions. They do that RM minus RF, you know, as a blocking action before you get the space back. Anyway, I found out there's some tools and they're called the Fast Unix Collection or something. Anyway, they have two commands, CPZ and RMZ, and they are super fast implementations of RM and CP written in Rust that are hyper-paralyzed.
Right.
Okay. And that deletion of slash user local, that 11 to 16 minutes goes down to about 30 seconds, which is quite astonishing.
So you ran this on the Ubuntu latest or whatever the yep. default GitHub Action runner that most people uses. Mm-hmm. Have you tried this on any others? Like, I don't even know what other options are available on GitHub. Or are some of the alternatives, like Blacksmith, I think is an alternative. Do you know if they present like huge volumes of unknown, like blank space to the runners?
Blacksmith.sh do just present lots of space in the root file systems. You don't have to do any of this shenanigans. And if you're looking for a fast alternative to GitHub Actions that support GitHub Actions, they're a really good option. You just change one line in your workflow to say you're using Blacksmith and all of the other stuff just works. It's great. But I didn't want to pay for that. And I didn't want to pay GitHub either. I wanted to have my cake and eat it too. So yeah, I'm doing all of this crazy stuff. But what happens now is that nothing but Nix creates the 65 gigabytes, runs this background task that uninstalls a bunch of stuff, then goes and deletes a bunch of stuff as fast as possible, and then creates this additional volume, which is now 40 gigabytes. And you can create somewhere between sort of 100 and 130 gigabytes for your Nix volume.
Sorry, my maths is failing me there. You said the root partition was 20 gigabytes and then you delete some stuff from it and you've got a 40 gigabyte volume. How does that happen?
Sorry, the free space in the root partition by default is 20 gigabytes, and then nothing but Nix goes and deletes another 40 to 50 gigabytes of stuff out of it. So it actually,
understood.
In the end, the core Ubuntu that's left behind is only like 4.5 gigabytes,
yep.
But there's like an 80 gigabyte volume that's been allocated nice. For the root partition. So all of that deletion and purging happens in the background. And then when that space is available, that Nix volume is dynamically grown with ButterFS to be as large as it needs to be. And so I'm very happy. I can now run my large Nix configuration jobs and all of my stuff is cached and all my updates are super quick. And I'll have links in the show notes to nothing but Nix itself for anyone that is using Nix, and also a blog post that explains like how this works under the hood. And one of the things I was thinking about is, well, this is an interesting trick. Like, if you need to build large container images, you could do the same trick, but mount up the partitions for where you want to put your container images, for example. Maybe you want to pull in lots of container images in order to complete your build. But the idea I've had is taking something like QuickEMU, a project that the three of us have worked on in the past, because in GitHub Actions, the free tier and the paid tier, you can enable KVM acceleration to do pass-through acceleration to virtual machines that you can run on the virtual machine that is the GitHub runner. So my idea is you could use this extra space to provision your own virtual machine image in a GitHub runner, enable the KVM acceleration, and then boot your own VM inside a GitHub runner in order to do like your golden build using your validated, certified, and secured build environments, or build tons of container images that you wouldn't have space to do, you know, otherwise. So that's my little life hack for GitHub. I'm rather pleased with that, and I'd be interested to hear if anyone else finds a need for creating gobs of disk space on GitHub.
I rebooted an old website that has been dead for years, and it's not mine. It's a website that somebody else made, and then for some reason it shut down, and I decided to reboot it. And I have been thinking and talking about doing this since about 2021, maybe before then. But over coffee the other day, Martin kind of gave me a nudge, and I just did it. And so now I now have another domain and website to look after.
To be fair, I didn't realize that I was nudging you to do this thing. I was showing you something else. This started by moving your blog onto a different platform, but then it kind of snowballed.
Yeah. So this is called Nerdy Day Trips, and it was started back in 2011 by Ben Goldacre, who is a famous doctor and kind of celebrity doctor who writes for a number of organs, although doesn't quite so much right now. And he was looking for like a database of nerdy places he could go when he's in a particular town. And he wanted a map so he could like find where these nerdy places are and go to them. Like, you know, it could be a museum, it could be a very specific museum, like a transport museum or a pen museum, or it could be just some architecture that people go nerdy about, right? It's not necessarily a computer thing. It's whatever you think.
Whatever somebody finds to be nerdy.
Yes, exactly. And it was basically just a big map with loads of pins in it, a Google map with loads of pins in it. And the data was crowdsourced back then, starting in 2011. And there were a lot of pins put into it. And then the site kind of disappeared in about 2016. Now, there were problems. I remember seeing spam attacks on the site and seeing that they didn't have very good spam protection. And so there were lots of nefarious posts being placed. And I don't know quite why they shut the thing down. It could be a combination of things, but the fact that Google changed the way they license Google Maps could be one. Maybe getting sick of all the spam will be another. It's a project that maybe ran its course. So while nobody's like publicly acknowledged why it went away, it just went away. And that's fine. You know, sometimes things die, but also sometimes things are reborn. And so I decided to...
like the phoenix.
Yes, I decided to rebirth this phoenix. And it started, like I said, in 2021. I was chatting with Will Cook and Stuart Langridge, my good friends. And we thought, and we chatted, and every so often we'd like throw together some mock-ups or a bit of data. And one of the problems is seeding a website like Nerdy Day Trips with the pins, like the places. Like if you start with an empty map, it's not very motivating for other people to crowdsource that data. You know, if Jimmy Wales opened a blank website and said, hey, this is Wikipedia, everyone go crazy, I don't think anyone would be throwing money at him. So I was chatting to Stuart about this some years ago, and he went through the Internet Archive and pulled some of the data, scraped some of the data. Not all of it, but only some of it, because of the architecture of their site. It was, the Internet Archive doesn't have a full copy of the data. It only has whatever was on screen when the archive caught it. And so we have some data, like about 1,000 pins or something like that. And I took that blob of JSON and I mashed it a little bit and turned it into some markdown files. And because everything gets fixed with Hugo in my mind, I used Hugo to build a little website in which there is a map with all the pins in it. And there's some buttons to do various things like search and look at the details of each of where the pins are.
So as you describe this, Hugo is a static site generator. This, what you're describing, doesn't sound like a static website. So how did you pull this off?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Each of the locations is a static page. It's a piece of markdown with a bit of front matter that's the GPS location, lat long, an address, a title, and maybe some other metadata about the place, right? And there's one file per location. And they're in subdirectories based on country, region, that kind of thing. So that you haven't got just like one big folder full of markdown files. It's about like 30 folders full of markdown files. And the site gets built and published. Like initially I did this locally, just on my local workstation, and it works. Like the site uses the data in the markdown files to build a JSON blob, which gets loaded, and we use leaflet.js to show the map, and we're using OpenStreetMap instead of Google Maps, and you see all the pins. And yes, it's a static site. There is no editing. It's not like Wikipedia. You can't just press a button and edit what's on the page. However, I pushed all of this into GitHub. So now you can edit that stuff. You can go to GitHub and go to the Nerdy Day Trips project, and you'll see website is in there, and you'll find all the little markdown files buried in a folder or bunch of folders, and you could edit those to update them, or you could create new ones. What then happens is, if any changes are made either to the website itself or to that data, it gets built and pushed to Cloudflare Pages. I could have used GitHub Pages, but I didn't. I used Cloudflare Pages. I thought I'd try something new to me anyway. And so every time the site is updated, it gets rolled out a new build, and within seconds, the site is updated. The live site, that is. The problem is, it's a bit brutal to ask normies to go and edit a GitHub repo. They might not even have a GitHub account. And so what I'm currently building is a front end to that, which can resist spam and makes it straightforward for normies, non-GitHub users, to propose a new location to be added to the map, which goes through a review process, some automated, some manual, and then that turns into a pull request against the repository. And so by appearing as a pull request, it's just like any other change in amongst other people's edits to the code or edits to the database, as it were, and they get reviewed, and someone can see a preview of that as well, and merge it if it's an update that is desirable in the database. I say database, yeah, a bunch of markdown files on disk is a database in my mind.
So I'm thinking about one of the projects I was looking at a little while ago, is that translation of like 650 game strings in 56 languages. That started out as a Google sheet. You've got a GitHub repo, but that doesn't stop anyone from turning the data that's in there into other formats, right? You could turn it into a SQL database or whatever you wanted it to be.
Sure.
Because the data's open.
Yeah, I guess you could take that data and do something different with it. What I would really like people to do is just contribute to this. And, obviously, you know, someone might come up with a better way to render this information, which would be great, especially if they contributed and improved the website. There have been some iterative improvements. Like, we didn't have search, and then Stuart contributed a little search option. It's very much MVP at this point. Like, you can scroll around the map and you can zoom in and out, and you can zoom straight to a location, and there's a few like helper things in there, but it's not finished by any stretch. The big problem right now is making it easy for people to add locations and edit locations. And by the time you hear this, that may be done. But at the moment, as we're talking here, you have to edit the pages directly on GitHub itself.
You say it's MVP. I mean, how does it compare with the original website, you know, when it shut down in terms of, you know, its features?
Well, it's an awful lot uglier, for one thing. That's another thing. I'm not very good at CSS. And if someone wants to design a logo and contribute improvements to the CSS so it looks nice on both desktop and mobile, it's okay. It's usable right now, but it could look better and it could respond better in mobile environments and so on. If someone wants to contribute that, that would be awesome. The old site had a nice logo, a nice theme, and obviously a larger database of points of interest.
Right.
My main motivator for this is to not let what happened to the first site happen again. I would like the data to be crowdsourced, just like theirs, but I want the data to be kept in the open, which is why I put it on GitHub. I could have used GitLab, I could have used anywhere else, but I just happened to use GitHub. And yeah, it could move in the future. That's part of the beauty of it being all like open and built with Hugo, because you could build that anywhere and you could publish it anywhere. I happen to be using Cloudflare, but it could be published to GitHub Pages, or it could be published anywhere else or to your own server. This is just like the minimum possible Nerdy Day Trips website. I don't have their original domain. Their original domain was nerdydaytrips.com. I grabbed nerdydaytrips.org because I thought that went better with the idea of crowdsourcing, and it's just like a fun little project.
I've just had an idea, which is, because it's Hugo and it's a static site, there'd be nothing stopping you building the static site and actually having the static site on your phone, and it could be usable completely offline.
Feel free. I will not be doing that. I do have it on my laptop, and it's very easy to develop for. Like, literally, you clone the repository, you know, create a branch, and you can just run Hugo serve, and you'll end up with a local copy of the whole thing, and it operates exactly as it does remotely. The only difference is I'm using Font Awesome for some of the icons, and because of the free license I've got with Font Awesome, it only renders those for certain pre-selected domains. I think localhost is one of them, and nerdydaytrips.org is another. But if you published this as is to a host of your own, that bit probably wouldn't work. That's a forewarning, and I probably should put that in the README. But if anyone wants to contribute to this, I would welcome it, both in design and functionality and the data itself. Hopefully, by the time you listen to this, there'll be an opportunity to add whatever nerdy places you like to go to the database so other people can discover those places.
I have been pushing my Steam Deck to its limit with a new game.
Ooh. Do we need to ask?
Oh, yes. Sorry, I completely forgot the signs there. Is it a game with roguelike elements, by any chance?
No, it's not. Oh. In this case.
Oh.
Games with roguelike elements don't tend to be that demanding, do they?
It's like we don't know you anymore, Mark. The last two games, it's just like, no.
So I've been playing a game called Avowed, which is a first-person RPG set in Eora, which is the setting of the Pillars of Eternity games, which I have spoken of with great joy before. So Pillars of Eternity is an isometric party RPG in the sort of Baldur's Gate tradition. But this is set in the same world, but a very different kind of game. And when it was first announced, it was, you know, a short trailer showing the first-person view and someone walking around with a sword and casting spells. And everyone immediately assumed that this was going to be a sort of Bethesda-style RPG like Skyrim or Fallout. And there's elements that are similar, but it's not really like that to play. What I found really comes to mind when playing it is actually the most recent Tomb Raider games. So Tomb Raider, Shadow of the Tomb Raider, and the other one, which I can't remember right now. So there's a lot more focus on exploration and sort of crafting and quests and stuff. And it's not just one big open world where you can pick anything up and smack stuff with your sword and it goes flying across the room, which confused me at first because, you know, I'd climb up a bell tower and hit it with my sword and it didn't go dong. And I'd go, oh, well, that's a bit of a letdown.
So is it kind of, when you say it's like the Tomb Raider ones. It's kind of linear in that, like, you've got an open area that you can look around in, but you get taken from area to area throughout the game.
Exactly. So you've got quests within that area, but you're free to explore, and it's worth exploring because there's always something to find in each area. But it's not, you don't have puzzles to solve like in Tomb Raider. It's more narrative driven and character driven. And the environments look amazing. Like, they're really, like, graphically detailed, even if they're not sort of logically detailed in the same way that, say, Skyrim is. And there's some points which are obviously very deliberately made for you to find that you can then see across, like, the land, and the music ramps up and you think, wow, that's actually quite impressive. Like, even on the Steam Deck with all the graphics settings low, there's still quite an impressive draw distance and you can see a lot of detail in all of this.
So is that what you're alluding to when you say you push the Steam Deck to its limits? You had to, like, dial stuff down because it can't cope with this? Or is it just that it's possible if you've got a bigger GPU, it could do more?
Well, this is the thing, is the game's rated as playable on the Steam Deck. So Valve has a rating system where they have, I think, 5 criteria which a game has to meet for it to be Steam Deck verified. And it's rated as playable, but it's rated as playable because you have to manually invoke the on-screen keyboard when you name your character. Aside from that, all of the other criteria, including that the default graphic settings give it, you know, are playable. It's playable with the default graphic settings it gives you. That criteria is met. And that's not quite what I found when I played it at first.
Were you playing it on the TV in big resolution or handheld?
A bit of both. I've tried it in both just to see where the limits are. And it's certainly better in handheld, but not perfect. And I'm still playing it rendered at 720p, just blown up to a big telly.
Right.
So it's not like I'm trying to render it in 4K. That would be a tad silly to expect. But I found a few specific issues, which I actually spent quite a bit of time when I started playing, fiddling around with to see if I could work out where it was they were coming from. So the first thing I found was that in dark areas, I kept on looking at walls and seeing this weird sort of black stippling effect all over, which wasn't quite lined up with the shadows that were being cast. I couldn't work out what was going on. So I went through flicking every graphical setting to work out what was going on. And I found that if I disabled ray tracing, that went away.
Always turn off ray tracing.
Always turn off ray tracing, right. Noted. Because, yeah, normally it's not on by default and I don't tend to turn it on.
Right.
But yes, in this case, it was on by default and it was causing this problem. And once I turned this off and then I saw the shadows where they were meant to be, I realized that they looked like very jagged polygons, like sawtoothed edges on all of these shadows. So went through and found the settings again. I found that I could just about get away with nudging shadows up to medium. And it didn't have much of an impact on the frame rate and they looked a bit better. Then a little way into the game, once you get through the prologue, you find yourself on a dock, like next to some ships, and there's ropes along the edge of the dock, and then there's sea, which is very pretty and very nicely animated. But then I found if you look at the interface between the sea and the thing in front of the sea, there was this weird, almost like a JPEG artifact all the way along the screen. So I wasn't very happy with that. I was finding this was breaking my immersion a bit. So again, I went through and found there's a setting in the graphics which is just called effects. So I notched up the effects and this problem went away.
Oh, it wasn't just on or off. It wasn't a binary.
Oh, no, this is a slider. Right. This starts off low and goes up to ultra, whatever. So I moved it from low to medium and this problem went away. So yeah, quite happy so far. The frame rate's still decent enough.
When you say decent, like, what is the frame rate? And is this a game that's like frame rate sensitive?
It plays at about 30 frames a second fairly solidly.
Right, which is reasonable for a game of that type on a Steam Deck.
Yeah. And you know, you notice when you come into a new area, when you load up, you see the textures load and everything. It's not like everything's like bam, you know, your eyes melt with the glory of it. You've got to set your expectations accordingly. But once everything's loaded and you're playing, it's going at 30 frames a second quite nicely. You don't really notice a huge amount of slowdown too often. But there was one remaining problem, and that's a weird ghosting effect that I'd noticed, which was most apparent when I mentioned before it's a first person swords and sorcery type game. And when you draw your weapon, as the blade moves across the screen, you see a sort of ghost of it. And the best way I can describe this is imagine you're looking at a picture on an e-reader and then you change the page to another picture and it leaves a few dots behind of the previous picture.
Mm-hmm.
But you're seeing this in real time on a rendered game. Or the other thing that it really makes me think of is if you ever played like an early graphical adventure like Myst, when they wanted to, you know, you pick up an item off the background and they wanted to show you fading it out, but they didn't really have transparency effects then. So things would kind of dissolve.
Oh, like a stipple effect.
Exactly. You get this same effect, which, yeah, it kind of gives me this really weird nostalgia for like old like DOS and early Windows games, but within this amazingly beautiful 3D environment, which is quite strange.
Do you know if this is because you're running it on a Steam Deck, which is lower power, or is it Linux, or is it the drivers? Is there any indication from other people's support conversations what could be causing these kind of things?
Yes, I did find a promising thread which was discussing this, and some people, you know, one person saying, "You, I've got it. It's definitely not this, or this. It's definitely not the drivers, the hardware. It's just it happens."
Right.
And other people say, "Well, I don't see this." And what they narrowed it down to was a feature of the Unreal 5 engine on which this game is built called temporal anti-aliasing.
Yeah.
And essentially what's going on here is it's inventing additional frames of animation.
Right.
So I suspect if I was playing it on something which could deliver a higher frame rate, and then I set a frame rate limit of what I was actually seeing on my telly. So say it could, you know, I could peg it at 30 or 60 or whatever, then I probably wouldn't see this. But because I'm playing it on, you know, a reasonably limited device, it's giving me a smooth experience, but the payback is it's not actually rendering all of the frames I'm seeing. It's making some of them up as it goes along.
Yeah.
And in some cases, not doing a good a job of it as others. Unfortunately, there isn't any option to turn this off in the graphic settings and seeing if that makes a difference. It's kind of baked in.
Okay.
Yeah, I was just looking it up, actually, and I found the Unreal documentation where it told you how to turn it off in the editor, if you're the game publisher, right. But not. Yeah. Like, I couldn't see a command line option, which would be ideal. Sad.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's an INI file in the game data somewhere you can go and twiddle that.
Yeah. So this was an interesting discovery. And, you know, it's something I've got to, I've just decided I'm going to live with this. It's slightly annoying, but really I'm enjoying the game and it doesn't pull me out of it too much that it would upset me. What it has led me to wonder, though, is are we sort of starting to hit the point where modern games aren't going to be able to target the Steam Deck as a sort of lowest common denominator anymore? Because I think, you know, Valve's obviously always trying to get people to be Steam Deck verified and setting these criteria. You don't have to be able to play it with any particular level of graphical fidelity. You just have to have a setting that it will pick up by default on the Steam Deck where it works. But if it's going to have issues like this, and if that's going to cause consternation with gamers, maybe game developers might get to the point where they say, well, there's no point because we can't get it running nicely enough that we don't then end up with a load of complaints about the game. And will we reach the point where Valve can come out with a new revision before that happens?
I think you might be surprised at how much effort developers are prepared to put into getting a game running on smaller devices, because the Steam Deck has a massive footprint now of like users as a console. And the efforts that some of the developers have gone to for sort of big, grand 3D games have gone to port it to the Switch are just astonishing.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that they've had to profile and debug and improve in order to get their games on the Switch, because there's an audience there, I think there's probably enough people now with Steam Decks that there's enough motivation to make it work well.
I'm looking forward to all these YouTubers who do low-end gaming on like old Pentium 4s. Like in a few years, they'll be doing low-end gaming on Steam Decks. Like, oh, look at this arcane device that, you know, can't do modern gaming. But hey, I can play Doom on it.
Yes, so when I play my next game, I'll report back and let you know if I'm still having ghosting issues.